does agree that Hosea chapter 7 is one of the most difficult chapters in the book of Hosea, if not in the whole Bible. There are, in fact, two problems in this chapter. The first is the question, do these words preached by Hosea apply to the nation or to the church? Are we to take these words and these judgments politically and so apply them to the state of a nation? Or are we to take these words and judgments spiritually and apply them to the state of the Church of Christ? And the answer to that problem seems to be that, in fact, both are true. The Word of God is capable of being applied in all sorts of ways to all sorts of situations. And the truth in Hosea 7 applies both to the state of a nation politically and to the state of a church spiritually. Because, of course, in the Old Testament, the nation was the church. It isn't like that since the gospel of Christ came into the world. No nation on the face of the earth is now the church of God. The church of Christ in the New Testament is amongst the nations. It is scattered. It is what the Apostle Peter calls the diaspora of God, the broadcast seed of Christ throughout the church, throughout the world. But no one nation is now the church of God. But in the Old Testament, it was different. Israel was the Jewish church of God, and church and nation were one. And so there is both a political and a spiritual message here in Hosea chapter 7. The other problem is this. There is such a riot of imagery in this chapter that most people reading it find themselves a little bit bewildered. One moment Hosea is using imagery from one area of life, and the next moment he is hiving off into another world and uses completely different imagery, and that can be somewhat distracting. It's like watching a film when images and photographs are flashed on a screen in rapid succession, and it seems as if the photographs and the films have nothing to do with each other, and so it can be quite distracting. Now, the way to overcome that difficulty, I believe, is to imagine the prophet Hosea as a kind of newspaper reporter with a flashbulb camera. And he's trying to take in the state of the nation and the state of the church all at once. And so he runs around, as newspaper reporters tend to do, and whenever he sees something of interest or importance or significance, he gets out his notepad and his flash camera, and he records the incident. And once you have this idea in mind of Hosea going round the nation and going round the church and photographing something that is important, then I believe this series of images in Hosea 7 tends to make sense, and the chapter gels together. Now, the first of these images is found in the first verse. And the chapter starts in a doctor's surgery. And God, the great physician, is examining the patient Israel. In chapter 7 and verse 1, when I would have restored the fortunes of my people, or it can read, the health of my people, when I would have healed Israel, then the corruption, the rottenness of Ephraim is revealed. Can you see the picture, therefore, taken in by the flash camera? The patient has come to the surgery for a medical examination. The patient is Israel, and he knows that he is sick, there's something wrong in the nation, and there's something wrong in the church. And the nation and the church are in need of healing. And so they come to Jehovah, the great physician, and the doctor starts to probe the patient. And what the doctor finds is worse than the patient suspects. And it's worse than what the doctor suspects. You see, the patient Israel has come to God with what he thought was wrong. An innocent swelling. A slight cough in the mornings. A tiny fleck of blood. And the doctor sees in the patient a deep malady requiring radical surgery if the patient is to get better at all. And so it is very often with us. We come to God, the great physician, with what we think are our failings and our weaknesses and our foibles. And we say, "Look, Lord, I think I'm in trouble. I confess so-and-so, and I confess so-and-so, and I confess so-and-so, and I really am guilty of X and of Y and of Z. These are my failings and my weak spots, and I need help from you, God." So the doctor says, "Now, let's have a look at this, and let's see what's really wrong with you, and let's see what lies behind your description of the illness." You see, symptoms are not the disease. The symptoms are the evidence of the disease. They are the outward show, the spots, the swelling, the cough, the fleck of blood. But they are not the disease. They are the symptoms. And doctors don't treat symptoms. They treat diseases. We tend to treat symptoms because, even as Christians, we tend to be interested in the superficial. But the great physician goes behind the symptoms and he probes deep down to get beyond the symptoms to the heart of the disease. And so in verse 1, Israel comes to God with the symptoms, the malaise in the church and the nation, and God probes. And what he finds is rottenness. When I would have restored the health of my people, when I would have healed Israel, the corruption of Ephraim is revealed. And I believe that as Christians, we always need the courage never to be taken in by mere symptoms alone, by the outward show of what is wrong. Christians need the courage and the wisdom and the grace and the fortitude and the insight to go beyond the symptoms to discover the disease. Have you the courage to do that as a Christian? First of all to yourself, and then to others. That's where this chapter begins, in a doctor's surgery. "When I would have restored the health of my people, when I would have healed Israel, the rottenness of Ephraim is revealed." And then suddenly Hosea is out of the surgery, and he's into the common life of the people, into the streets, and into the homes. And in the second half of the first verse, what he finds outside the doctor's surgery is a society in chaos. In the second half of verse 1. They deal falsely. The thief breaks in. And the bandits raid on the outside. The first sin that is mentioned here in the high street is the dishonest dealing in shops and markets and supermarkets. They deal falsely. And what Hosea is referring to here is summed up in the old Scottish word, jukery packery. There is jukery packery in the high street. In other words, swindling and cheating and cooking the books and rigging deals. I remember the awful scandal that there was in my last parish a few years ago in Lanarkshire involving redundancy monies, when it was obvious that some of the industries were beginning to fail. Men would come forward voluntarily to retire and so receive redundancy money, sometimes as much as £3,000 a head. And the man retiring thus with £3,000 would enter into negotiations with another man, who would enter into negotiations with another man, and another man, and another man. And a wicked system was somehow devised by which men could go on living on several lump sums of redundancy monies which they had drawn. It was beyond me how they did it. It was vastly ingenious, and it was quite dishonest and iniquitous. They deal falsely is God's verdict on that. And the words could also apply to the more recent scandal in the furniture removal business. Perhaps you saw the expose on television when someone moving house wrote to a removal firm asking for a quotation. The firm would then tip off several other removal firms. Prices were discussed privately and compared. Deals were made on the sly, and several quotations were sent to the householder wanting to move his furniture. Naturally, the person wanting to move would be tempted to take the least expensive quotation. But in fact, the least expensive turned out to be a way above what any of the firms would have put forward as a competitive estimate for moving the furniture. It was a scandal and a swindle. And reputable firms with names to maintain had to start investigations. God's verdict on that is, they deal falsely, and it's a sign of social anarchy. The second item that Hosea singles out in the high street is this: the thief breaks in. It's astonishing how hardened we can become to recurring crimes. Burglaries are now so common in our society that they're generally ignored. Some of you know that I had 9 burglaries in my last manse in Lanarkshire, and after the first few, I was shocked at how hardened and blasé one can become. That's one of the frightening things about crime and sin. One becomes inured to the most fearful things. Northern Ireland, Uganda, Afghanistan, South Africa. And so nowadays, when a few folks can still remember when doors were very rarely locked, burglaries are so ordinary that they're scarcely commented upon. The thief breaks in, says Hosea, and it's one of the signs of social anarchy. In New York alone, thousands of cars are stolen every day of the year. And a friend was telling me that in the part of Connecticut where he lives in the States, over 60% of the old age pensioners have been burglarized and assaulted. The third sign of social anarchy is this: and the bandits raid without. And the modern name for that is muggings. The bandits raid without. And that too seems to be a strange mark of our sick and disordered generation. The senseless violence that is done to old people in particular. Have you noticed the spate of such attacks on old folks lately? With violence and cruelty out of all proportion to the money that's taken from them. Violence against the aged. What does it mean? Is it aggression against God? Are they fighting God when they fight old people? Is it frustration because of worklessness? Are they fighting their unhappy homes? Or their fathers? Are they fighting their parents? Or what? It's a sign of a sick society and social anarchy. Outside the surgery, Hosea sees a society that is off the rails, dealing in shady deals in private, burglaries and muggings. They deal falsely, the thief breaks in, and the bandits raid on the outside. And then suddenly, the scene changes again. And Hosea looks into the faces of the crowds milling down the high street, and he photographs the next scene. And it is heedlessness of God. The man in the street, the common people, they are not exceptionally wicked. Some of them can be extraordinarily kind. But they all have one thing in common. God is not in all their thoughts. Verse 2. They do not consider that I remember all their evil works. They do not consider. Have you ever paused as a Christian to look into their faces on a Friday evening or on a Saturday evening, as I do driving home from prayer fellowship? The crowds bent on pleasure, half stupefied and half anesthetized by drink, absolutely unaware of God or of judgment or of heaven or of hell or eternity. Heedless of God. Let me say this again. That the cardinal mark of our generation is a lack of sense of eternity. The eternal nature of heaven, the eternal nature of hell, the eternal judgments of God in the world to come. Eternity is foreign to our generation. Some of you know that recently I was down at Worcester with my colleague and friend James Philip. And that was the impression we got of so much of the society in that lovely part of England bordering the Vale of Evesham. a heedlessness of God. For example, we found it almost impossible to find a church open on the Lord's Day for evening worship. We had gone to Worcester Cathedral in the morning and found it to be very high, with most of the service in Latin, and at the end of the service were invited by the priest in charge to pray for the soul of Sir Edward Elgar and for the soul of Frederick Delius, the two English composers. Elgar, for the greater part of his life, was a lapsed Roman Catholic. He was on his deathbed restored to the Roman Catholic Church and reaffirmed his belief in the teachings of Holy Mother Church. Delius was a humanist and an atheist and a renegade, and when he was not composing music, much of it of a decadent nature, he was in the seedy dens of Paris and in fact died of a disease contracted there. We were invited to pray for the soul of Edward Elgar and Frederick Delius. James and I were dying for a word from the living God. We asked a lady in the tourist bureau if she knew of a church that was open. I said, a low church and somebody who preaches a good sermon. Ah, she said, that'll be St. Nicholas. It's just down at the bottom of the street. So we went there. In fact, the church had been closed. It was now an art gallery, and she didn't know. And it's just as well it was closed, because the notice board was still on the wall, and at the top you could read the legend, Priest in Charge. Not very low church, was it? A waitress in a restaurant was asked about an evening service. We were desperate for a word from God. She said she never went to church and didn't know much about churches, but she thought there was a Baptist church in a nearby street. Another waitress passing by said, oh no, that's not a Baptist church, that's a Roman Catholic church. And so they argued. So James and I went to see. In fact, it was neither Baptist nor Roman Catholic. It was Elim Pentecostal. They didn't know the difference. Nothing daunted, we drove on, village after village. And in the villages where the parish church was not boarded up and completely closed, there was no evening service, just matins and morning worship, and the rest of the day to yourself. And as we sped through the villages, desperately looking for a place in which to worship, we could see the pubs bursting at the seams, crowded out, packed with folks, merrymaking, and some of them half drunk, spilling onto the streets and the highways, godless and heedless, until at long last, by the grace of God, we came to Malvern and to Malvern Priory, where we found two lovely evangelical young curates and about 30 people who could be bothered to come out to the evening service. And so we sat in the monks' stalls in Malvern Priory, that magnificent building, and held evensong. 22 miles to reach a place where the gospel was preached. And that is an impression that registers all over the country. Spend a Sunday in Inner Aberdeenshire, if you will, or Upper Banffshire, if you will, or down in Galloway, if you will. Heedless of God, and with no sense of eternity. And just to bring the problem nearer home, I spoke to a young lad on Friday who has been brought up right through the church organizations in this place. And I wondered why we didn't see him. He says, I'll tell you, I dinna care for God, and I'm not interested in the kirk, and I'm not coming. they do not consider that I remember all their evil works. And then the scene suddenly changes again. And in verse 3, there's a photograph of the government and the people at the top. And this is what God says. By their wickedness at the bottom, they make the king at the top glad, and the princes at the top by their treachery at the bottom. And the picture is this. The government at the top is pleased when there is wrong and harm at the bottom. Now, what can that mean? A government pleased at the top when something is wrong at the bottom. Let me give a practical example. Take the three great commercial worlds, the money-spinning worlds of tobacco, drink, and gambling. Gallagher's and Wills and Dobbies and Players, all the Ushers and the Dewars and the McEwans and the Tennants, all the Ladbrokes and the Littlewoods, the Pools and the Horses and the Dogs and the Bingo Empires. Money-spinning empires. Now, no one can doubt that vast fortunes come to the state by way of tax from these three industries, tobacco, drink, and gambling. The greater part of the price of a bottle of whiskey goes to the government, and it therefore follows that the more people drink, the richer the state is. And in the same way, the greater part of a packet of cigarettes or a pouch of tobacco goes to the government. It also therefore follows that the more people smoke, the richer the state is. And it's exactly the same with the gambling empires. The more people spend on gambling, the richer the government is through the taxes. But the more people smoke, drink, and gamble, the poorer they are. The poorer the quality of life is. The more unhappy they are. People who drink, the less money they have. And the greater the drain on state resources for patching up broken health and broken marriages and broken families, the chest problems and the heart problems and the weight problems and the emotional problems and all these things that are the byproducts of overindulgence. I have the greatest sympathy with folk and their struggles. But did you read the recent expose of the power of the tobacco lobby in Parliament? Power and money unite in Whitehall, and any attempt to stop advertising on tobacco or drink or gambling is ferociously resisted by the tobacco barons in London. And so you see, what goes on at the bottom makes happy the people at the top. And that's the meaning of verse 3. By their wickedness at the bottom, they make the king glad, and the princes by their treachery. And then suddenly the scene changes again. And in three verses, Hosea takes photographs in the baker's shop. First of all, in verse 4, he says they are all adulterers. They are like a heated oven whose baker ceases to stir the fire from the kneading of the dough until it is leavened. In verse 6, for like an oven, their hearts burn with intrigue. All night their anger smolders In the morning, it blazes like a flaming fire. Verse 7, all of them are hot as an oven, and they devour their rulers. The kings have fallen, and none of them calls upon me. The picture that is conjured up in verse 4 is a picture of men and women who are ablaze with uncontrolled desires and uncontrolled lust. They are all adulterers. They are like a heated oven. And no Christian can surely doubt that those fires in our day are being fed by the seamy films that are shown on television and the doubtful literature that is on the market and is classified as soft porn, and the questionable films that are labeled as art. I wonder how much the vile imagination of that evil monster Hutchinson, recently sent to jail for life for that appalling carnage that he wreaked on that poor family in England, I wonder how much his vile imagination had been fed on that sort of thing. It does seem extraordinary that his career in crime started at the age of 11. Could nothing have been done to arrest it, or control him, or to steer the man away from hell? If verse 4 speaks of uncontrollable desires, verse 6 also speaks of men and women who are out of control, their rage and their wrath out of control and scarcely concealed. In verse 6, like an oven, their hearts burn. All night long, their anger smolders, and in the morning, their anger blazes like a flaming fire. And in verse 7, that anger takes a very practical expression, because verse 7 is a reference to a revolution. The rage breaks out in insurrection and revolution, so that the king is removed and a new government is installed. All of them are as hot as an oven. They devour their rulers. They eat up their rulers. Their kings have fallen in the revolution, and none of them calls upon me. And then the scene changes yet again. And in verse 5, there is a photograph of the king's coronation day. And this is what happens on the day of the coronation. In verse 5, on the day of our king, the princes became sick with the heat of wine. And the king's coronation turns out to be a drunken brawl. The princes are sick with the heat of wine. Well, of course, one is accustomed to hearing of heavy drinking in high places these days. And the evidence of history is that it has always been like that. Political power, you know, is a very heady wine, and men tend to become drunk with it and have inflated ideas of their own importance, and so they lose control of their appetites. If you've read the autobiography of Aleluyeva Stalin, Stalin's daughter, when she escaped to the West a few years ago, she reveals the appalling scenes of drunkenness and riot and excess that took place in the Kremlin when her father Stalin was in power. The guardians of the people and the champions of the working classes, sodden with good food and rich wine, when Russia was starving. On the day of the king's coronation, says Hosea, the princes became sick with the heat of wine. And Hosea goes on to say in that fifth verse that the lapse into drunkenness was the least important sin on the coronation day. Getting drunk, after all, is very easy. And getting drunk, after all, is a very obvious sin. It is a sin of the flesh. But the next stage in verse 5 is more sinister. Because in the second half of verse 5, we read that the king, while they were all drunk, stretched out his hand with the mockers. And you know that in the Old Testament, mockers are a class apart. They are the cynics. They are the skeptics. They are the worldly wise. And they are against God. Well, it's one thing to get drunk, but it's a more serious thing to stretch out your hand with the cynics who are against God. On the day of our king, the princes became sick with the heat of wine, and the king himself stretched out his hand with the mockers. And lastly, the scene changes again. And in verse 8, you are back into the baker's shop again. The reference here is to dough being mixed. Ephraim mixes himself with the peoples. In other words, the nation had lost its identity. It was no longer a distinctive nation. It had mixed itself with the Gentiles. And a church too can lose its identity. A Christian church can cease to be a church. The book of Revelation speaks about churches that have become the synagogues of Satan, citadels of wickedness. A church can lose its identity. It can mix itself with the peoples by becoming a place of entertainment, as some churches have. When the church compromises or waters down the gospel or changes the message, when the church mingles itself with the nations and the Gentiles and the outsiders and so dissipates its strength, it ceases to be a church. It loses its identity. Ephraim mixes himself with the peoples. And in the second half of the verse, Ephraim is a cake not turned. Or as we would say nowadays, Ephraim is a half-baked scone. And the reference is to the flat scones that they still bake in the Middle East. And the dough is rolled out and thrown against the wall of the oven. Or it's laid on a hot flat stone. And you've got to turn the scone at the right time. Or else you get one side burned and the other side raw dough. Ephraim is a half-baked scone. Unsatisfactory. Inedible. Neither the one thing nor the other. And that lies at the heart of a church that dissipates itself and its strength among the nations. Half-baked Christians, half-committed Christians, half-converted Christians, neither the one thing nor the other, neither cooked nor raw. Ephraim mixes himself with the peoples. Ephraim is a half-baked scone. I think I've missed the climax of this great chapter, which we'll come to next week, but look at it now. It's the last line. And he says that all of this shall be their derision in the land of Egypt. When a nation or a church loses its identity, when it allows vice and drunkenness and immorality to run riot, when the king becomes a cynic on the very coronation day, And when the government hauls in money from the weaknesses and the failings of others, Hosea says, Egypt laughs. This shall be their derision in the land of Egypt. And so in the end of the day, what really is at stake in this rather grim chapter is the honor of God and the renown of God and God's character and God's fame and God's worth in the nation and in the church. The nation must come back to God. The church must come back to God. The ministers must come back to God. And the elders and the Christians. If the laughter of Egypt, the enemy of God, is to be silenced. And so the final word of this chapter is a word of grace. It's the invitation to come home to God, to the God who loves you, to the God who pursues you, to the God who loves you with an everlasting love. Amen. May the Lord add his blessing to the preaching of his word. To his name be the honor and the praise. God willing, we'll look at the second half of that chapter next Lord's Day evening. Hymn number 46, in closing, Charles Wesley's lovely words. What shall I do, my God, to love, my loving God to praise, the length and breadth and height to prove, and depth of sovereign grace? Hymn number 46.